So good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Hi, virtual audience. Thank you for tuning in. And welcome to H.A. Finn, who is doing his first formal event here, although he snuck in along with Kristen Hanna. It was a big day. Sophie Hanna, Kristen Hanna, and A.J. were all here in the store at the same time on a rainy Saturday in March.
I remember that.
You do. Yeah, I know.
Yes, it is. I remember that. Yep.
Right. For the woman in the window when it was just taking off. So one of the reasons I always encourage you to come to a debut author is you never know whether they're going to suddenly become a worldwide bestseller like AJ, right?
You don't know.
Oh. So, you know, surprise. If you weren't here, you can't ever have bragging rights is really what it comes down to. But also, and I have to say that brand new authors really appreciate the support. You know, they're scared, they're worried, they don't know, right? Do you remember how you felt?
Oh, I still feel scared and worried. It's a
Well, of course, you wouldn't even go out and talk to people.
It doesn't leave you, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a really nice thing to do if you're choosing among our ridiculous calendar which events to come to. Often it's nice to pick the one where, you know, it's a new author, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we are here to talk tonight about the Gothic and the revival of the Gothic, but also an Agatha Christie-style Gothic. But first, we might want to talk about San Francisco, because this is not the San Francisco that you might recognize today in this novel, is it?
I was wondering, Barbara, if I could provide... who has read the book and who has not? What the fuck?
Language?
Sorry. But
that's okay.
Now I know that we should tread carefully. I was just going to provide you with like a three-sentence précis of the novel. So end of story is the story of Sebastian Trapp, who is a legendary crime fiction writer who over the course of his career has penned about 24 historical novels in the vein of Agatha Christie or Arthur Conan Doyle. And for some years now, he's been engaged in a long-distance, long-term correspondence with a young woman on the East Coast named Nikki Hunter, who's a crime fiction enthusiast and expert. And before the action of the book commences, Sebastian has just written to Nikki to say, bad luck, I'm dying, I've got kidney failure, 3 months to live, so why don't you, as my fan and as a writer yourself, come out here, live with me in my lavish mansion in Pacific Heights, alongside my second wife and my grown daughter, and help me write my memoirs. And Nikki accepts this somewhat curious commission, in part because she really does love Sebastian Trapp's work, and in possibly greater part because she's intrigued by the central mystery of the man's own life. 20 years earlier, on New Year's Eve 1999, Sebastian Trapp's first wife and teenage son vanished from separate points in San Francisco, never to be heard of again. And as Nikki and the dying man collaborate on his life story, she comes to suspect that someone in his inner circle, or perhaps the man himself, knows much more than what they've admitted about what really happened that night.
That's a really excellent summation.
It's a masterpiece.
Well done. Great. So you, the discerning reader, will already know that there's no way that this book will continue without figuring out what happened on New Year's Eve 1999, right? Yep. I mean, you know that coming into this story. But and it's an important feature of the book and of any Gothic novel. And I say Gothic because there might be some sort of supernatural things going on, but usually there's a house. There's a really good house in a Gothic. Think about Rebecca. Think about Manderley. A book that actually ended when the house burned down, which is why there was never a sequel.
You know, Rebecca 2 never happened.
That's right. Yeah. And so, you know, The Fall of the House of Usher, for example, the Edgar Allan Poe. Think about Agatha Christie and Country House Murders and so forth. So you do need a great landscape and a great house. And for the story you're talking about, a foggy city on the bay with a long history is an ideal place to set it. Now, I remember you writing me some desperate emails from time to time from San Francisco saying, I just can't get to grips with this story, or send me an Agatha Christie. Actually, I mean, to really be fair to AJ, he did. Not only is there, are there Easter eggs about Agatha Christie in this book and a thoughtful index at the end, so if you didn't catch them, he will tell you where you can go find them, which I think was very helpful. But you tried to buy we didn't always have them, any number of Golden Age crime novels.
Yes.
So that must be sort of a passion for you.
Well, you were pretty amply stocked, as I recall.
Well, some of them were hard to find because books don't always stay in print. But I was impressed at the range of interest that you had when you would send me an order and say, you know, and then I'd have to do a little detective work. Sometimes I'd have to say, buy it on Amazon, because there's no way we're going to find
I could imagine your face as
you wrote those words. Yeah, no, it's fine. But so, it, you know, you've been in publishing. I mean, that is your career before you were an author. Mm-hmm. So you obviously are really well-versed and well-read in the Golden Age kind of thing. Has that always been an interest for you?
So I was lucky enough to grow up with two parents who both read, and particularly importantly, my dad read. And I say that's particularly important because I think that for a boy, it's important to see his dad read. A lot of boys do not grow up to become men who read. My brother has read, I think, literally two books in his life. I don't know if either one of them was mine, which is a bit grim. But I did see my dad reading Dick Francis and Nelson DeMille and all these authors. And I became a very devoted reader. And every summer, we would repair to my mother's family's generational homestead, which sadly was sold in 1997 in East Hampton, New York. And this was this Victorian mansion down the road from the ocean. And I know that sounds grand, but the place was pretty dilapidated. At the same time, there was, it was like being in a fun club where you might get in trouble. There were servants' quarters, long abandoned, on the top floor. And I remember how some servants, long before my time, had carved his name, Frederick, into the wall. And my cousin Pete, who's 9 years older, at night would sometimes steal up to the attic and walk the boards above our rooms. And then at breakfast the next day, he would say, you know, did you guys hear Frederick last night? And we would just void our bowels. It was really, really scary.
So you had an actual gothic experience.
It was a properly gothic experience. And the pool, I recall, was coated in this stucco, like cut glass, so that you would emerge from the water just bleeding like a Russian royal. I loved it. It was so much fun. And so my first book, The Woman in the Window, features a house that is itself pretty gothic. Lots of rooms, lots of atmosphere. I feel that atmosphere is an element of storytelling that quite a lot of authors leave on the table. It doesn't cost much. It's pretty easy to establish atmosphere quite quickly, and it can become its own character in the book.
It should, actually, if you are interested in the kind of potentially supernatural themes and so forth, then, you know, you're right. They can't just, like, show up at a picnic site. You know, you do need them to be in some kind of excellent contained enclosure. So this book has taken you a long time to write, between The Woman in the Window and now, several years.
Seven. Oh, shut up.
And, you know, here's one thing. When you have a supernova success like The Woman in the Window, it's very hard to write a second book. And, you know, Knives Out, this book has been compared in some ways to fans, or suggested that fans of Knives Out, you know, will really like it. But very often readers, and especially critics, mm-hmm. do have Knives Out after you've had a mega seller. It's just human nature, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, to do that. So there was some pressure on you to write a second book that you were going to be happy with, regardless of whether anybody else was.
Do you know, the success of the first book, for which I am profoundly grateful, is something that I regard as, it was this wonderful adventure. I don't think I'll ever have it again. To repeat myself, I'm profoundly grateful for it. And in a way, it was actually quite liberating. Gillian Flynn, whose Gone Girl was significantly more successful than The Woman in the Window, has not yet followed up Gone Girl. And
she's 13 years out.
She's 13 years out.
That's right.
Gosh, she is, yes.
I talked to her about that because she was here last year with an author. She has her own imprint now.
Yes.
And she published a book. She's at her imprint. She asked me if I could do something wonderful for her new author. And I said, sure, if you come. You know, I mean, wasn't even hard, right?
Yep.
And she, you know, but I think partly she's been so engaged in television and script writing and other things. I don't think it's all been like writing.
Well, no, she's been writing screenplays and
Right.
Launching imprints. I got a dog. So
that's just as time consuming.
I think we're equally busy. You know, it has been 7 years since I started writing this book. It's been 6 years since the publication of The Woman in the Window, because I began writing this book before this was actually submitted to publishers. And it has come up a couple of times on the road. This is my fourth week on tour. This question, essentially, gosh, hasn't it taken you a long time to write this book? And it has. And when I was talking to my publicist about this, I said, oh, my knee-jerk response is to be glib, try to be charming and say, I got a dog, or something cute. And the reason I've not been doing that over the past couple weeks is because I got sort of tired of it. And I recognize this sounds confessional. I don't mean to cause discomfort. The fact is that when I wrote The Woman in the Window, I did so in response to a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, as you and I have discussed. That was on my birthday, my 36th birthday, July 21st, 2015. I'm 44, if anyone was doing the math. And I had been struggling with depression, or what I thought was depression, for 14 years. And while I was and remain grateful for that diagnosis, and while the 2 to 3 weeks it took me to adjust to my new medication afforded me the opportunity to think of the idea for this book and to begin writing it, I felt very frustrated and quite angry, and I'm not really an angry person, that I should have lost so much time to a misdiagnosis that is extremely common with bipolar disorder. And not too long after the publication of The Woman in the Window, I became very, very depressed again for a number of years. And I know that's not cute, and that's not glib, and I know no one's asking me to be charming or glib, but that is what took me so long. And what helped me enormously was a treatment that I had first undergone in 2011 and then again in 2012, which is ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy, which sounds quite scary. And certainly when I heard shock therapy for the first time, I thought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Shutter Island. But
Nurse Ratched was Nurse going to come into your life.
That's exactly what I had in mind. But that was what was eventually got me out of this years-long blight, and that's what helped me finish this book. And at this point, and not to sound unprofessional or cavalier, but at this point, having gone through that, a deep trough, several times throughout my adult life, and having now written two books, of which I am proud, I think, Barbara, I am going to swear again. I think, fuck it. I've written these two books. If that took me 7 years, and that took me 7 years, but so I'm quite proud of
these. I wasn't asking you to apologize.
Oh no, I know you weren't.
No,
guys, stand.
I know.
That's what I want.
I was thinking that, you know, possibly the best therapy you've had is the dog, but you know.
And I do want to say a word about her, because there is a dog in this book.
There is, and also you will notice that your copy has a paw print. Or it will have
when you ask
him to sign. No, those were the mail order.
Oh, I see.
Right. But when you get your book signed, he will
have
add a paw print to your book. So in tribute to the puppy that isn't here.
So after The Woman in the Window was published and after I returned from my tour, I thought, right, I'm going to reward myself with a dog. I'd grown up with dogs, but they were big dogs. And because I live in Manhattan, I couldn't get a big dog. So I settled on the French Bulldog. And I reached out to a breeder in Michigan who said, well, I've got a little boy, which is what I wanted. He's the runt. Are you still interested? And I said, yes, of course I am. So I went to Newark Airport a week later and met the pet nanny who is a real gig, and I want this gig. She's an off-duty flight attendant whose weekend job is to roam the country just like dispensing puppies from her bag, which I thought sounded magical. Yep. And she descends the escalator, and I run up to her, and I say, hi, I'm Ike's dad. I decided to name my little boy Ike. And she pulls Ike from her bag, and Ike has got this crumpled black mask and these steep bat ears. What he doesn't have is a penis. And I'm sort of looking, like, I don't mean to be gross, but I'm sort of looking in that area. And I said, like, this is not a boy. And the flight attendant, I remember, she said, oh, it's not? I said, I'm an expert. Nope. And they sold me a girl. And I don't know if they knew they were doing that, but she's still my dog. She's still called Ike. So she accompanies me most everywhere, but not on this trip because it would mean too many flights.
I can tell you she's truly adorable because in our email correspondence, AJ has thoughtfully sent me photos.
Many.
Like, you know.
Many photos.
Like,
thank you, Barbara.
You know, like grandparents send photos of their children.
Yep.
I have photos of Ike, who is truly adorable. Right. And we got puppies in the pandemic. So I can say, you know, if we hadn't gone out to dinner first, you know, one of my jobs is to take the author out for at least a drink and dinner and all before we come here so that the author is generally in a good mood and not fainting away from hunger. And partly that's because their travel schedule is so erratic that meals are hard. And very often at the end of an event, all they can look forward to is room service somewhere because, you know, it's too late. But anyway, if we hadn't done that, I would have brought Scooter, who is a star here at the store. He's an adorable little white Cavapoo, and he just lies down there and looks adorable.
That's what I do.
I know.
I would love that.
I'm sorry. Next time we'll eat afterwards.
Next time,
right.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. But anyway, back to the book. When you were working on it, I know that it's a complicated story, and it's difficult to pull together all the plot threads when you have so much going on,
yep.
You know, both forward and then backward, because in order to work on what is essentially a cold case.
Yes.
And then you have to have a present case in order to make the cold case
yes.
make any sense. It's really hard to hold that together. So I was sort of envisioning you, you know, like some kind of weaver, you know, there you were with like a book loom and you were weaving things along.
Love
so
that.
I figured that took you a fair amount of time.
It did. Authors are often asked about their process. I don't really have one, and I don't say that to be coy. But many authors classify themselves, you might have heard these terms before, as either a plotter or a pantser, meaning you plot your books, as I do, or you write by the seat of your pants. And I know some authors who claim that they like for their characters to surprise them. To which I say, if my characters surprise me, my medication isn't working. I do not wish to be surprised by my characters. The Woman in the Window only took me a year. And in part, that's because I was in a different state of mind. But in greater part, it's because, put it this way, in the years since its publication, the people who have talked to me about the book have commented on how they responded not to its plot, but to what they have described as its emotional intensity or
right.
its poignancy. And not to do down my own work, but I think the book, The Woman in the Window, I mean, is a good, solid mystery. I think it's fairly clever. It is not, you know, it's not Agatha Christie at her best, I'll tell you that. It is, I think, the intensity and the sadness of it that distinguish it, if anything does. And that's because I am myself a fairly intense person. I'm a fairly sad person. This is sounding like my Tinder profile. And that's why that book worked, I believe. This book is also intense.
Mm-hmm.
It is also quite sad.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I want to do for the remainder of my career. I want to write books that people can, thrillers, that people can enjoy superficially, just as twisty, turny thrill rides, or as a more layered experience, something more haunting even. That said, this mystery is several steps above that of The Woman in the Window, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It is much more elaborate, and it just took a lot of work. I don't think I'm a natural plot smith. So it was tough.
And you have a bigger cast.
It is a bigger cast. The Woman in the Window was comparatively easy because it was one central character.
Exactly.
Narrated in the first person. And when you narrate in the first person, you can achieve, I mean, almost complete intimacy with the character, to sound, well, that's how I would describe it, complete intimacy with the character. Whereas when you are narrating in the third person, as we are doing here, it is possible for the characters to keep things from you. You're rubbing shoulders with them. You're not actually in their head. And there are more characters. They actually set foot outside, as nobody did in The Woman in the Window. So this was a challenge.
Right. Well, you're talking about the reader. The reader can, first-person narration, the reader can only know what the narrator knows. It's, there are occasions when the narrator lies to the reader. Mm-hmm. There are, for example, going back to Agatha Christie, if you read The Murder of Dr. Aykroyd, you know, at the end of it, you know that he lied to you, you know, throughout the whole book. Whereas if you're reading third person, as you say, the reader gets, you can hide things from the reader. I don't know whether you as a reader bond more to one or the other. You know, I think every book is different. Every story is different, works out. How many of you have read The Woman in the Window? Aha.
Oh, God.
How many of you saw the movie? So did the movie affect, I assume you read, well, maybe not. I know, for example, that most people who talk about the Maltese Falcon never read the book. They all saw the movie, and so they're seeing Humphrey Bogart, and you know, and so how many of you read The Woman in the Window before you saw the movie? Okay. Did the movie affect the way you felt about the book after you'd read the book and then you saw the movie? Did your reaction to the book or the way you think about the book, did it change it at all?
And that was the right answer.
Usually it is for a reader. Yeah. Most readers do think that the book is better regardless of, you know, but there are occasions. Sorry?
Also a good answer.
Right. Do you have a movie contract for end of story?
No. So because of how this book ends, and the ending is very elaborate, mm-hmm. I would say, we elected not to submit it to any of the early reader sites like NetGalley. We elected not to submit it to Hollywood. We didn't submit it to Hollywood until publication day.
Good.
I think that was the right call. The market is significantly different than it was when The Woman in the Window was submitted, mm-hmm. in that studios and streamers have only within, I think, the past 6 months realized that the math doesn't quite work for that business model, I would say. So they are contracting significantly. Studios and streamers are buying a lot less than they were just half a year ago. They're canceling series left and right.
Right.
That said, I mean, my hope is that this will be sold, but I don't think we're going to see any action for another couple of months. Probably.
Well, the writer's strike and the whatever also really slowed things
Absolutely,
down.
Absolutely, they did.
I think, you know, the Knives Out franchise, I think that's a decent parallel to this, you know, could very well be not, you know, long-term television, multiple episode television, but maybe a movie.
I can see it either way. I remember sitting in the cinema watching Knives Out thinking, oh, but because that was 2019 and I started writing this in 2016. I thought, yeah. Oh gosh, are people going to think I ripped this off? No. Yeah. And Knives Out is quite, I love Knives Out. It's very funny. It's essentially a comedy. This is not. But it has helped popularize or repopularize this sort of country house mystery style right. of entertainment.
So I promised a couple of authors who I hope are watching that because we've had discussions about the Gothic, because if you have noticed that the horror novel and the Gothic novel have sort of surged into popularity. And that's true of fiction, is that different kinds of fiction rise up and then everybody gets tired of it because there's so much of it, and then it goes down and something else comes up. But because I think that's going on, what's your understanding of a Gothic novel?
I love the Gothic and always have done, although I was never a goth myself. I was a very
that's
preppy
different.
Teenager. Yes, it is quite different, isn't it? I never listened to My Chemical Romance or anything like that. But was that Please Don't? Oh, missed out. Sorry, that's the opposite of what I... There you go. Duly noted. Thank you. But I like the Gothic. Oh, gosh. Why do I like the Gothic? And by I say I like the Gothic, I mean I like everything from jokey Gothic, like Adam's Family Values, to... I remember reading The Mysteries of Udolpho and The Castle of Otranto, these two, the first Gothic novels, I think, which were published 200 years ago for a college course. I like the Gothic because it is sometimes very heightened. And I think the way I write is probably a bit heightened in a way that I hope readers find accessible. Everybody in this book, I'm veering slightly from the Gothic question, but I'll get back to it. Everybody in this book speaks as I would like to speak. They're wittier than I am. And they don't do what I'm doing now. They don't pause for breath. They don't say or ah. And I like that. As an author, I have the opportunity to to make a story tidier, I guess, every scene in this book is set someplace distinctive, for better or for worse. Nobody, you never follow anybody into the bathroom. We never, like, you know, just take time out for what we would call or indeed experience as real life. The book, therefore, is in those respects a bit heightened, and in its atmosphere in particular, it is gothic. I like the gothic because it is menacing without being, and often sometimes, dangerous. It is never violent, really. It is never gory. It's a style and an attitude as much as an aesthetic. This is probably the most inarticulate answer I've given to any question I've ever been asked.
Sorry, it was a tough question.
No.
No, I mean, I think you know, claustrophobia is part of gothic.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
You know, vampire is a different thing. A vampire novel, it's designed to, you know, in part scare you. You know, the supernatural actually brings in supernatural elements. We have a great one coming up next Saturday, which I love, but then again, I'm not crazy about snakes, so I have to kind of balance that. But I mean, it really, you know, there's the actual menace is not human. It's not it's external. Whereas the gothic, I think the menace is very much very human and generally internal, and that's why it needs the house or the castle or whatever, because it all arises within. And so if you have set this book in a Victorian mansion in San Francisco where it's foggy, mm-hmm. you know, the whole bit. Now, I was saying to Dan at dinner, my San Francisco is not today's yep. San Francisco. When I went to look at colleges, my family took me to visit various colleges, and this is 1957. So Duke University, for example, was busing its female students under heavy guard to the men's campus because they were having serious race riots. It was only 2 years after Brown versus Board, 1 year after Brown versus Board of Education, and the South did not want to desegregate its schools, including its university. So I ruled out Duke, being a girl from the Midwest. So in the end, I think that I wound up at Stanford largely because it was in California and it was very, very special. And I say that because it was a very formal city. It was very much like old Boston. And I remember my mother and my sister and I walking around the city, and my mother was wearing white tennis shoes, and she would not go into the Palace Hotel for lunch because she was wearing tennis shoes and she didn't have gloves. That's how formal San Francisco was. By the time I left Stanford in 1963 after the other degrees, it was Haight-Ashbury. It was, you know, it was totally transformed. And then Silicon Valley came along. My graduation party was hosted by a guy named David Packard, and none of us had any idea where his money came from. Seriously. You know, nobody knew what was going on about that. So the transformation of San Francisco from an old-style, very formal, almost Victorian kind of, you know, after they rebuilt it after the earthquake, because it was pretty wild until the earthquake came on. You know, it was Gold Rush City and the whole bit, was astonishing. And I think your book is set in that older San Francisco. And so some readers looking, you know, reading it are going to think, that can't be San Francisco, not in this book, but it really is.
So this book is set in San Francisco for the simple reason that while America is teeming with interesting cities, I don't think too many of them can be described as mysterious. There's right. San Francisco and maybe New Orleans, which I've never visited.
Right. But and they have to be old cities, too. It's very hard to have a really new city like Phoenix be mysterious.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. So it's I mean, San Francisco has the advantage of natural phenomena like the rolling fog, mm-hmm. like the spooky woods that encircle the city. But it is very much a sanitized and cinematic and stylized vision or version of San Francisco. There are no tech bros. There is no homelessness epidemic. It is a movie San Francisco.
Right.
But I hope a fairly evocative one.
And also, the other thing about San Francisco, I think, makes it really interesting, there is a constant menace called the San Andreas Fault. And San Francisco is always at risk of being struck. And, you know, so the city itself is always kind of, you know, in
is
a
attention.
State
yeah.
of suspense, right?
Yes.
Because you don't know what, you know, at any moment what might actually happen.
San Francisco is also convenient because, personally, when I read a book and it's set in a city that I know of, I want the tourist's experience.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really see a point in staging a novel in San Francisco, but not taking the reader to the Golden Gate Bridge or glimpsing Alcatraz or talking about Muir Woods. So all of that happens or is alluded to in the book.
Right, because you're bringing in somebody who doesn't live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You're bringing in the East Coast person.
And it's fun for them, yes.
Right, so that's really fun. But I think this book really needs San Francisco. I don't think this book would read the same if you had sent it in, like, Portland or something. Well, you know, a lot of Omaha, you know, would not have been the same. Well, it just wouldn't.
It probably would not.
Right, so how much time did you spend there while you were working on the novel?
Not too much because of COVID. For the most part, COVID knocked out a lot of the prep and writing time for this book. I used Google Earth quite a lot. I have, before the book was actually submitted to my agents and then to my publishers, I did visit San Francisco a few times to fact check. And I found the city beguiling in its way, enchanting in some parts and troubling in other parts.
Right.
I will say that when my agent returned the first draft of this book, which is about twice as long as it is now, she said, there's a French bulldog in the book named Watson, after Sherlock Holmes' sidekick, of course. And she said, Dan, my first note is this: I know what the goddamn dog is doing in every chapter of this book. And I start rereading the draft, and I realized I'd written a novel about a French bulldog that lived in a house where people kept getting murdered. And
that's actually a pretty good
yeah,
plot.
Please nobody steal that, because, yes.
Not bad. Well, yeah, no, I can see that. So in a Gothic novel, you have to have someone in peril, usually a female, right?
Yep.
Most Gothics have a woman in peril, but in this one, you have a missing woman.
Yes. This is my second consecutive novel to feature a female narrator. The next book will feature a man. I've been asked a couple of times, well, more than a couple of times, why I have written from the perspective of women. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago, I think, that a particular incident clarified for me why this is the case. I was walking my dog in Tribeca, Lower Manhattan, where we live. It was a sunny weekday morning, and I saw a pretty young woman crossing an intersection en route to a Think Coffee. And I saw a delivery van curve around her, and the driver of the van leaned out and shouted something unspeakable at her. I don't know if I stopped. I like to think, I don't know, I was horror struck by this. But what really broke my heart was that she kept walking. She was not wearing AirPods. She definitely heard him. I think I saw her shoulders stiffen, or maybe that's just artistic license, but she heard him. And when I got back to my apartment with Ike, I found I couldn't stop thinking about this. I'm a gay man, and I can count probably on one hand the number of times someone has shouted faggot at me in public. It is not a nice feeling. It is demeaning, and it is intended to demean. It makes you feel vulnerable. But I'm also 6'3", 185. There are not many situations in which I feel uncomfortable. It occurred to me that this woman, every single time she left her apartment after that, and probably every single time she left her apartment before it, must have felt acutely vulnerable or alert to the possibility of danger. And I had never really considered that. There's a moment in this book where Sebastian and Nikki are talking about how Sebastian thinks that women make better crime writers than men, something I believe. And she asks why. And he says, well, every day they've got to contend with sinister forces. She asks what? He says, men. And I think that's true. I cannot imagine what it is like to be a woman and to feel, on some level, I expect, constantly on the alert for potential abuse or threats or danger. And at the risk of sounding crass, these are useful qualities in a protagonist in a suspense novel.
Well, Wilkie Collins called his The Woman in White. It wouldn't have the same ring at all if he called it The Man in White, for
no.
example. And yeah, I do think, I'm trying to remember the fall of the House of Usher, who in fact was at risk there. It's been so long, probably 70 years since I read it.
Well, Madeline, same name as the character in this book, is one of those at risk.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it is female.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So the other part of the book, I think, is really fun, since you've got a mystery writer, you know, as your... Is there something autobiographical in it? Do you think of this as a little bit metafiction in the sense that you're bringing writing into it and, you know, all the rest of it?
So I personally, and I know you're not suggesting this, while I don't believe that fiction is the place to settle scores, I think it would be silly for me to suggest that I don't write to some extent autobiographically. Mm-hmm. I mean, every single character came from here. So just as Anna in The Woman in the Window has a lot of my, I wouldn't say qualities, attributes, Sebastian, our crime writer in End of Story, is not dissimilar to me in that, I mean, he's more charismatic, he's more polished, he's more charming, he's taller. But what I like about this character is he's kind of full of himself, but he also knows it. And I personally find that a not unattractive quality in a person when they are aware of their own, if not ridiculousness, then their own muchness. And he's fun. I find him fun. I liked spending time with him. As for the references to other crime novels, this is easy for me on the most part because I have read a lot of crime novels in the past. And just as setting a scene in a spooky or atmospheric house is an easy way to generate feelings of dread in the reader, alluding to other books is an easy way, one might almost say cheap, to persuade the reader of your bona fides and to encourage them to get into the spirit of things.
Okay. Well, I think what I was groping towards is we're in a moment in which writers are often expected to write only what they themselves are from their own culture or their own gender or whatever it all is. There's a lot of pressure. Tony Hillerman, I think, would not be able to publish The Blessing Way and the Jolie porn series today. So I think what I was sort of getting at is that you are writing about a mystery writer.
Yep.
In a way that only you probably can write about. I didn't phrase it very well.
No, you did.
It would be, I think you can bring something authentic and truly your own to writing about Sebastian, a famous mystery writer, when you, in fact, are the same.
What I like, one of the attributes of this character that I appreciate is how he feels defensive of, I suppose, but also proud of this genre. And I do, certainly. I'm quite proud to write in this genre. I've always been very proud to read in this genre. I get quite frustrated when people look down on mysteries for often, if you ask me, often because they have plots and they're successful. And I was saying to one of your colleagues tonight that while I like so-called literary fiction, it's got to have a plot. And as I note in this book, plenty of so-called literary classics, at least in America, but elsewhere too, are mystery novels. The Great Gatsby is a mystery novel. To Kill a Mockingbird is a crime novel. Native Son is a crime novel, etc., etc., etc. Lolita is a crime novel. It's not a dirty word. I mean,
you know, this reminds me, it was one of the most painful moments I can ever recall in hosting an event. In 1995, P.G. James made her only visit to the Poison Pen. And we were over at the Scottsdale Library, and the crowd so overflowed the auditorium that I went upstairs and got the Scottsdale TV station to come down and set up their cameras and broadcast the inside out to the outside. So it was huge. There were probably 800 people there. And she gave a really moving talk and talked about, you know, the highest and best that she, and human nature that she could write about. And she, I mean, it was a brilliant talk and everybody was just struck. And at the end, when people raised their hands, this guy stood up in the front row and looked at her and said, "When are you going to write a real book?" Ooh. I'm serious. I thought I was just going to die because, you know, I felt like because he was there on account of us, sure. I was an awful moment. And I thought, I couldn't figure out his mindset. I mean, she had made a really passionate, you know, talk. Uh-huh. And there he was going, when are you going to write a real book? And as you know, in England, for years, the review media, the London Times, I wouldn't review crime novels. They thought they were just trash, you know, and they only reviewed remember that?
I do, yep.
And, right, so I'm not entirely sure, but it seems to me that it has gained far more respect. And as you say, many of the great American novels are, you know, mysteries at their heart.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Right. So maybe we should ask for questions.
Sure. Yes, please.
Sorry, I'm losing my hand.
Yes, ma'am.
You say you read a lot of authors.
I do.
Yourself?
I'm sort of the best, so no, I am not the best. Most of the authors I read are dead, and this is because I think I'm sort of old-fashioned in my tastes. In part, it's because having worked in publishing for 10 years, I know too many of the living authors. And yeah, I'll just leave that sentence there.
It allows you to remain the best.
It does. It sure does.
Right.
So amongst the dead, I love Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh and P.G. Woodhouse. I love Sarah Caldwell, about whom I was just asking you. I love Daphne du Maurier. My favorite author is Dickens. If I could read nothing but Dickens for the rest of my life, I wouldn't be happy, but I would accede to it. Amongst the living, there's an author who's got a book out, I think it just came out, called Tana French, who I think is wonderful. She's a great writer. And one of the, just a brief digression, there is this, to me, troubling vogue or fad or demand for the huge twist. And if you go onto Amazon, not that you should, but if you go onto Amazon, you will see metadata attached like a tail to the title of a book, and it'll promise this is the most shocking twist you'll read this year, et cetera, et cetera. And I suppose that's fair in some instances. Some books are constructed solely to surprise. They're like Jacks in the Box or Jack in the Boxes or whatever the plural is. But in other instances, I feel it's almost inappropriate to walk away from a book saying, well, that surprised me, so it's a success, or it didn't, so it's a failure. And I go into all this because I remember reading Tana French's debut called In the Woods. And although I am terrible at guessing whodunit, I'm very, very bad, I did in that instance. Like within a paragraph, I knew whodunit. I didn't care because the book is so gorgeously written and the characterizations are so rich and the atmosphere so pungent. It's just a magnificent novel. So I recommend her work. I like Kate Atkinson a lot. There's a book I've been recommending pretty regularly of late because I found myself thinking about it and then rereading it 10 years or so after it was published, called All the Birds Singing by Evie Wilde, W-Y-L-D, which is literary fiction, but with a plot and a suspenseful edge. And I also like Carl Hiaasen a lot. You're
very
welcome.
Very varied list. I like that.
Yeah. All right. More questions.
Who's it? Yes. Hi.
Mine's similar, but kind of different. I'm a big fan of Karen Slaughter.
Do you know about my relationship with Karen Slaughter?
Yeah,
okay, good.
I watched your guys' Instagram live.
Wasn't she great?
I love her so much. I remember you saying that she's kind of, because you've read and edited a lot of her books, that she's kind of influenced.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. So Karen Slaughter, for those unfamiliar with her, is an American novelist based in Atlanta. She's hugely successful. She sold 40 million copies worldwide. I had the very good fortune. She's right over there. Her books. She is not herself right over there. It'd be great if she were just hanging out there.
She'll be hanging out here in August. Always here the last week in August, and we raise money. You know, she's a kitten fan.
She is a kitten fan,
so
yes.
When Karen comes, the Newborn Kitten Organization here in Scottsdale always comes and brings kittens for adoption or fundraising. It's a thing
she's
that
awesome.
We do.
She's an awesome lady. I really like her books very much so, and they influenced me because they're smart.
Yeah,
agree. They're smart mysteries. In that vein, and are you referring to authors whom I've published?
Okay, yeah.
Let's keep it there. Yes, I've been lucky enough over the course of my career, which was 10 years, to work with some extraordinary authors. And there's an author whose books you've probably got stocked here, who's not very well known in the States, called Nikki French, no relation to Tana. And Nikki French are actually a husband and wife team, Nikki Gerard and Sean French, who are lovely, 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 lovely people. And they also were basically trailblazing the psychological suspense genre in which I participate long before Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train. I mean, like more than a decade before that. I strongly recommend you check out the work of Nikki French. And they have written a series. Most of their books are standalones. The best one. I love Beneath the Skin, and I love Until It's Over. But they also wrote a series, an 8-book series, beginning with the book Blue Monday. I recommend everything they've written. And the other author with whom I worked, who has made a big impact on me, is a Canadian novelist named Louise Penny, who's great. And I think her work will be read generations from now. And again, it's just elevated. She writes mysteries that are really smart, really, you know, satisfying as mysteries go, but the attention to detail and the characterization, the world building. I guess I respond to authors who seem to bring more to whatever it is they write.
You know, world building is a really good thing. We don't talk about it all that much. World building comes up more often when you're talking about science fiction and fantasy authors. But the truth is that, you know, this was world building. You built a special world there, and I think the most successful authors are the ones who not only write great characters and good plots, but also are successful at world building, so that you get to step into a place that feels real to you but may not be familiar, which is a whole different thing.
So, yes, sir.
Your last book had like Hitchcockian draw, and I was just trying to connect and think, what's his masterpiece? Many people think Vertigo, and
yes.
Vertigo is a great, great San Francisco homage.
Yes,
I wonder if that had any influence as to what you did with the new book.
Yes, well spotted. Vertigo definitely influenced this book. The Woman in the Window was expressly influenced by cinema, particularly Rear Window, exactly, and film noir and Hitchcock, although film noir and Hitchcock are not really the same thing, but both of them did influence that book. This one is influenced more by Golden Age detective fiction, although ultimately it is perhaps a bit deeper and darker than some of those books, but Vertigo influenced it as well. Vertigo is my favorite Hitchcock film, despite the fact that it's actually, if not his only film, then one of the very few of his films that isn't funny. Ever. It's never funny.
I like To Catch a Thief because it really is funny. Besides, it's Cary Grant.
There is Cary Grant.
Who didn't like
yes.
Cary Grant, right?
But one of the characters, Madeline, is named after Kim Novak's character in that film. So, yes, well observed. Was there anyone else?
Patrick, are you coming out from your lair? Sorry, was there a hand in the back before Patrick gets there? Monitoring the Facebook and the YouTube things to see if anybody watching it has questions.
Oh, okay. Well, while you do that, I can. I don't know if there are any writers here. Oh, do you have a question?
Question about the movie version of The Woman in the Window. Did you have much input into that?
So the movie version of The Woman in the Window was for me a terrific experience. Fox, the studio to whom we sold the rights, were so inviting and so accommodating. They did not need to be. They bought those rights. They were theirs. And every time I visited the set in Brooklyn, I visited the set 3 times. The director, Joe Wright, would embrace me warmly. He was terrific. I met multiple times Amy Adams, the star. And it was just I'm forever grateful for all that. My only contribution, I think, to the movie, because I did not write the script, I did not executive produce or anything, was to make very, very clear to Fox that I really, really wanted Amy Adams. And I really wanted Amy Adams because I think she's a magnificent actress. I also think she doesn't have much vanity. I mean, she's a beautiful woman, but she doesn't have much vanity. And that was not a part in which any actress was going to necessarily look dazzling. And it just, the movie had a bit of a rough ride after production because Disney bought Fox and then scheduled it for May of 2020. But then COVID interfered, and I remember thinking, will anyone ever see this film? And happily, Netflix heard that Disney had a movie about a woman who couldn't go outside, and they thought, that is our demographic right there. So it went to Netflix, and it was thank God it was number one around the world. It was just very successful commercially, and I feel extraordinarily happy with the film. It did spawn a spoof. There was an 8-part parody series with which I had nothing to do, called The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. And I remember it had been described to me as a spoof of psychological thrillers like My Book and Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train. And I'm watching the film or the TV series and I'm thinking, no, this is a spoof of My Book. And I love spoofs. I love Airplane. I love The Naked Gun. I love all that. I know we're on camera. I'm just going to say, I didn't think it was actually that funny. I didn't. I would have liked to have liked it more, but I didn't. And what I was about to say, there's more, Patrick, or am I good? What I was about to say is, I don't know if we've got any writers in the crowd, but I am asked sometimes whether it's, you know, fun. It's not. It's, I don't love writing. I love meeting readers. That is genuinely gratifying. But these are two emails that I've received in the past week, sent to me through my website. This is from Roseanne in Canada. Hi, Roseanne. Subject, end of story. Message, you are a good writer. But way off base about women. No woman thinks like that, ever. It was so exciting to receive an email from the spokesperson for women. I cannot tell you. And then the next day I had a question from Ellie. Hey, Ellie. This one says, just one question. Message. Why the bogus name, Dan? Fuck's sake, Ellie, it's called a pen name. Like, it has its own name. It's pretty common. Bye, Ellie.
There are lots of writers that have pen names. I know. Yeah, I mean, right. And if you were in publishing and you... Yeah, you probably really wanted a pen name.
I did. That's why I chose one, because I worked in publishing. But that's it was all of a secret for all of 48 hours. I mean,
if that.
Yeah, if that. So, but it's just waking up every day to stuff like that. It's just, it really gets you going.
Why do you read it?
Well, it's sort of, you know, when you get an email that says just one question, I don't know. I thought it might be like, hey, this is Henry Cavill. Want to meet?
Well, I thought you had Tinder for that.
I do. He blocked me on Tinder.
Right. I made a decision a long time ago, which is one reason the store has survived for so long. I don't have any personal social media. The only thing I do is I do the Instagram for the store, and I do not respond to direct messages, nor do I utter any.
Yeah, I didn't.
I am 100% insulated from Amy at her ilk. I mean, seriously, you know, I am. Patrick gets more of it, or actually Bill's the one who gets the emails that come in to the bookstore in general, right?
It's his turn.
Right, that's right. You did it for a long time.
Yeah.
And it really is amazing, some of them, right?
Yeah, I deactivated my own Facebook account.
Yeah.
I was like the last person to join. I got to say, it was the best decision ever made.
Right.
We have a couple questions from Jane Ann Krentz and JT are both tuning in. JT
Ellison. That's exciting.
And this is a great question from Jane. She says, trust is such a core element of the Gothic. What is the enduring appeal of the unreliable narrator?
So for those very few, I'm sure, who don't know, Jane Ann Krentz and JT Ellison are two New York Times bestselling authors who's, I would love to have anything like their careers. So thank you so much for tuning in. And the question was about trust and was that enduring appeal of the unreliable narrator?
I think I added enduring. Sorry, Jane didn't say that.
What
is the appeal of the unreliable narrator?
I suppose it's fun on some level. As readers, certainly, we like to be deceived. I mean, that's why we read mysteries. A mystery necessarily at some point involves deception, right? But it's kind of less fun when it's consequential, when it's in our lives. So it could be that little sort of static shock of, ah, you tricked me, but it actually doesn't matter much. And I suppose when I read a book that has, that features an unreliable narrator, whether I am aware at the time that I'm reading it that the narrator is unreliable, or whether it's only at the end that I come to appreciate that or understand that. It is interesting for me on a technical level to perceive how it is being done or how it was done. There are many good examples of this in fiction, Roger Ackroyd being probably the paramount example. But Gone Girl is another great example. Throughout the first half of that book, we are completely on one character's side. And this is because we are listening to her version of events as narrated in the form of diary entries. And then in the middle, there's this almighty twist where we realize that we perhaps have misjudged the situation. There is on some level a pleasure in being fooled, I suppose. I think Jane herself could probably come up with a better answer, but that's all I'm capable of.
What do you think, Barbara?
What is the appeal of the unreliable? Wow, I was sitting there thinking about, you know, in a classic mystery, there are elements that are laid out for you, and you are engaged in a kind of a duel of wits with the author to see if you can figure out what's happening before you get to the end of the book. And in a fair play Golden Age mystery, you should be able to do that if you're really paying attention. And there's a whole group of rules by a Father Ronald Knox. Remember Father Ronald Knox?
Yes.
Who wrote them out. And a couple of things that always stick in my mind was, and you have to remember this is 1920s England, so don't be offended by the language, but one of the things he said was no Chinaman. In other words, you can't have a character suddenly show up at the end of the book and that's the crux of, you know, of the mystery. You can't bring in some exotic character that nobody knew. The other thing he wrote was no doppelgangers, meaning, you know, you can't have identical twins. And when you get to the end of the book, it turns out that, you know, it was a twin that did that. Now, having said that, the first Charles Todd mystery, A Test of Wills, which is a wonderful book and was up for prizes and all, it's a doppelganger. You know, they broke the rule. Remember, it is a doppelganger. But in an unreliable narrator, it's a completely different thing. Basically, the idea is that the narrator is lying to you, and so you have no chance. There is no fair play involved, right? Because you're not learning. I mean, I'm not sure that Roger Ackroyd is entirely an unreliable narrator, because if you really pay attention, you should be able to figure out at some point that he is lying to you. But if you're reading something like Gone Girl, it's a revelation rather than a deduction. And so I guess that's probably what I would think of as the difference, is that, you know, revelation is different than deduction, and it's a different reading experience.
That's what I meant to say.
Thank you, Jane. Did JT have a question?
Nope.
All right. Not so far. Well, thank you all so much for attending tonight. I'm very grateful to be here and to see you. And thanks especially to Barbara for hosting
me. You didn't
want
to top my answer?
I'll tell you later, because it was, I don't want to embarrass you, but.
Good luck.
Thank you for having me.
It was really fun. You know, Patrick, PK, could you look behind where my purse is and see if I actually laid down an advanced reading copy? Because I have a terrible feeling that I forgot to bring it up here. Did I do that? I know I picked one up. There it is. Yay. I like to give away a book to all of you. Yes, there it is. Right. It's perfect. How many numbers have we got? If you'd bring me the book, that would be exciting. Sorry? Okay. So what we do after we thank you for coming, round of applause first for A.J. Finn, right? Because he's already thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.